Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Under the sea, darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me.
Good morning. Well, as Storm Gertrude wreaks havoc across the UK, we take refuge from the watery deluge with a watery exploration of our own. Yes, joining me today is esteemed maritime archaeologist Christopher Dobbs, who started his career supervising divers on the excavation of the Mary Rose Wreck, once Henry VIII's flagship, which tragically sank just off the coast of Portsmouth in 1545, and has been described by David Starkey as England's Pompeii. Now, head of interpretation for the Mary Rose Trust, Chris has had a colourful career, including 5 dives with His Royal Highness Prince Charles, taking part in the first ever live underwater TV broadcast, and being one of the team underwater as the Mary Rose was raised. Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
Good morning, Matilda. It's great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Now, you've got a diving-related experiment coming up. Would you please tell the listeners what they need to take part at home?
Yeah, if they want to get organised in advance while we're chatting, they need an empty fizz bottle with the fizz taken out and water filled in nearly to the top. They'll need a pair of scissors, some bubble wrap and some small sort of normal-sized paper clips. And and for another demonstration, they could have a complete bottle of fizz that's still got the fizz in it.
Yep, so sealed, not opened yet.
Yeah, so one sealed bottle of fizz, one a used bottle of fizz but filled up with water, paper clips, scissors and bubble wrap.
Brilliant. We will be coming to that later in the show, as well as hearing all about Chris's time with the Mary Rose and what it's like being a maritime archaeologist and the science involved. But also we want to hear from you as well. So archaeology is all about discovering old things, and we want to know, what is the coolest object you have ever found? Tweet us at Soho Radio, and we'll be asking Chris the same question at the end of the show. Chris, this is your mixtape. You have chosen the music today. What are we starting with and why?
I'd like to start with Alleluia, not for any particular reason, but I just think it's a great song and this is a great recording.
And I've seen your flag on the marble arch, and love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken Alleluia.
The Mary Rose had a successful career for 34 years between 1511 and 1545. She did not sink on her maiden voyage.
Contrary to popular belief. Chris, let's dive straight into your career then. Can you start by telling me what a maritime archaeologist is, what they do?
Well, we investigate things, any bits of archaeology that are related to maritime. So yes, a lot of it is underwater, but it's particularly shipwrecks and ships, but also shipbuilding, ship supply. So if you can think of anything that's related to the maritime culture or maritime trade, that's what maritime archaeologists look at. But a lot of it is underwater.
This sounds like the coolest job ever. So how did you first get involved?
Well, in fact, I started by reading science at university. I was at Cambridge, like you were, reading natural sciences. And I did a year of natural sciences. And then I went on a fantastic expedition to the Middle East. And we went to all sorts of places like Damascus and Palmyra and Petra. And wow, they just really inspired me. So that's when I decided to change. And at Cambridge, it's a very good system. You can change subjects without, you know, losing anything. So I changed and did my last 2 years in archaeology.
Wow. And what inspired you to go to the maritime?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's important to be an archaeologist first. And I went to a series of 6 lectures on maritime archaeology. And I thought, that sounds much more fun than grovelling around in holes in the ground. So I specialised as much as I could in maritime field, and working underwater in my summer holidays, rather than going on land digs, because you had to see a certain amount of archaeological practice. And so anyway, that's how I got inspired in maritime archaeology. And I took up diving so that I could, you know, do it underwater as well as on land.
So the archaeology came first.
Exactly. And I think that that's quite important to be an archaeologist, because the real idea of maritime archaeology is to try, or underwater archaeology, is to try and do things to the same standards as you would on a land archaeological site. And that's what we achieved, or tried to achieve, on the Mary Rose.
And what was the first wreck that you ever dived on?
Well, not the Mary Rose, actually. It was during one of those summer vacations that I was telling you about. And one of the wrecks was a Bronze Age wreck, so thousands of years old, which we found some bronze weapons, pal staves and swords and things like that. But then also the same year, I went up and dived on a site called the Kenemaland off Shetland. And this was just the most incredible wreck, miles from anywhere, and dating to 1664.
Wow. Do they know what brought it down?
Well, it was actually wrecked in a storm. But the really fun thing about it was that in that first year I was there, 1978, I found some golf clubs. We were searching one area of the ship. We didn't even know there were golf clubs for a few more years, but we found these enigmatic objects. They were wood covered in lead, and they were the heads of golf clubs. And when we found them, they were the oldest golf clubs in Britain. But just imagine finding five golf clubs on a wreck from 1664. I didn't even know golf had been invented then.
Exactly.
And three of them were left-handed. So, I mean, there's just so many stories. And they were going out to Batavia. They were going out to the Far East. But
taking their golf clubs with them.
Yeah, and people wonder, well, why was it off Shetland? And it's because at that time there were hostilities between England and Holland. So the Dutch East Indiamen used to go all the way around the top of Scotland to then go round Africa, a very long way round. And so quite a few were wrecked off the Shetlands and the north, off the north of Scotland.
And what is it like when you go under the water and you are diving? I mean, is it scary? Is it a magical world? Can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't find it scary, but...
Did you ever?
I suppose the first dive I did in absolutely black visibility on the Mary Rose was quite scary, where you literally couldn't see a thing. You might have been wearing a blindfold. But I think on that, you know, once you've done it once, it gives you such confidence that, you know, you're not going to have any problems, that then... you can do it again. In fact, we didn't usually dive in those sort of conditions, but it meant if it was almost black water and you could only see sort of 3 inches, you'd have the confidence to do the work that you needed to do.
Wow. And have you ever dived in warmer water? Because I imagine, being in the cold, what do you have to wear?
Nearly all my diving's been in UK waters, which are, pretty cold and pretty miserable. But I did once get the chance to, get the chance to dive in Bermuda on another shipwreck. And
in the Bermuda Triangle?
I suppose it would be, but I don't go for those sort of Bermuda Triangle type series. And it wouldn't be science, would it?
No, absolutely not.
But this wreck, it was, again, I mean, there's so many great stories in all these shipwrecks. But this wreck, there was a couple of ships, but they got all dispersed. And one of the ships was stuck in this enormous storm for days and days, and they were, you know, pumping the ship for ages, and they were just giving up hope. And miraculously, they spied land, and they headed for a beach and got jammed in a rock, and everybody survived. It was a ship called the Sea Venture going to start the colonies or help with the colonies in America in 1609. And everybody survived, and they used those ship. They built with it two little ships to sail on to America a couple of years later. But a couple of people stayed behind, and it was an uninhabited island, Bermuda, in those days. And ever since the day that shipwreck happened, it's been a British colony. And also, there was a guy called William Strachey who wrote a fantastic account of this storm and talking about the lights, you know, jumping from mast to mast and how frightening it was. And he sent that account back to England in 1609, 1610. And a couple of years later, Shakespeare wrote The Tempest. And it's he uses quotes exactly from William Strachey's account. So this wreck, I mean, it formed the colony of Bermuda, you could say. And it also has...
founded, like, Shakespeare's Tempest.
Exactly. It's got literary things. So there's so many unusual things about shipwrecks. It's not just about ships. It's about the stories they contain.
Absolutely. Well, what has been your most memorable moment, do you think?
I mean, that's really difficult. I mean, there are so many, but I suppose it would have to be during the raising of the Mary Rose, I was underwater as when it was first lifted from the seabed, and just being able to feel the ship when it had been lifted just 3 or 4 inches off the seabed, to just feel it swaying almost in the breeze, but in the current.
Buoyant again.
But you imagine a whole sort of 300-ton ship, you know, 35 metres long, that is just swaying gently. And also, because it had just been raised off the mud, as it swayed, the water was sort of sucked in one side and blew out the other side, and it blew the silt with it. So there was these sort of puffs of silty water coming out from underneath
it. Like it's smoking or something.
Exactly, like it was smoking, like it was a dragon. And it felt alive. And that was an incredible moment because, you know, that's when it was, you could absolutely prove that it was all in one piece and we were going to be able to go ahead with the salvage. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning one morning.
Wow.
I mean, it was just amazing. And I suppose that's an example of a really big thing. But then, you know, on the Mary Rose, we also found lots of little objects which are inspiring and fascinating.
And we'll be coming to those later. I was actually, one of our other producers, Claire, was here just before the show, and I told her you were coming on, and she was like, oh my God, I remember the raising of the Mary Rose. She's like, that was the news moment, like, when she was younger, and she was, yeah, so excited. So, time for your second piece of music, Chris. What have you chosen?
I can't remember. I'll have to go and...
let me remind you, you've chosen the Shetland Reel by Willie Hunter.
Right.
Why
you.
Have you chosen the Shetland Reel?
That's the trouble with not having notes. The Shetland Reel, yeah, this is... yes, I was telling you about this shipwreck in the Shetland.
Mm.
And it's a tiny place with sort of 50 families. And I was there in 1978 the first time. And I think when the divers come and work on the shipwrecks, it's an interesting moment for them. And we show them what we find and give them talks and so on. And in our honour, they laid on a party, a Shetland Reel, a really... Scottish, well, Shetland don't like to think of themselves as Scottish, but it was a wonderful sort of dance party. And I just remember the Shetland Reel was one of the things that we danced. And I seem to remember an enormous amount of stomping in this dance. You just went forward and back and did a lot of stomping. So it wasn't like traditional dancers like, you know, the Reel of the 51st that you might do. It was very basic and easy for me to do. And this is the sort of music that accompanied it. And it just reminds me of those wonderful times with those beautifully friendly people in the Shetland Isles.
More than 26,000 dives to excavate the Mary Rose.
That was Chris with a cup and a straw and some water, giving us excellent bubble sound effects right there.
Trying to get you in the mood for underwater archaeology and give you the sounds of underwater.
So if you are taking part at home, you should have with you some bubble wrap, scissors, paper clips and a bottle of water. I have mine, Chris has his. Chris, what are we doing?
Right, well, if we get our bottle of water, and it's got a cap, we can just unscrew the cap at this stage and put it on the side. So we've got a big bottle of pop with a cap. Now, what we might do is to take the label off, because if you take the label off, you'll be able to see better. So if we get our bottle of pop, and with your scissors, but be very careful at home, you can just take the label off, and then, as I say, you'll be able to see a little bit better.
Yep.
So we got the label off. Then we get our scissors and our bubble wrap. So we're doing this at the same time. So what I want you to do is to cut a small bit of a bubble wrap that's at least 4 bubbles wide.
So if you've got the kind of standard size bubbles, not the giant ones, you want 4 bubbles across. And you're going to cut a strip.
Cut a strip, about 4 bubbles across. Then what we want to do is to cut a vertical strip. So literally we've got 4 bubbles by 1 bubble that aren't pierced, okay? So you've got 4 bubbles vertically, and then to the side of that, you've cut through the other bubbles, okay? Then you get a sort of smallish size paperclip, a normal paperclip.
Okay.
My ones have nice sort of plastic coverings, but they don't.
I've gone for a like pink paperclip.
So we add, and if you've only got big paperclips, it might be a bit heavy and you just have to have more bubbles. So what I've done now is I've hooked two of the paperclips onto the bottom bubble, and therefore
so that's
burst.
The one that we burst, yeah.
Yeah, so I've now got a row, three rows of bubbles vertically and two paperclips hanging from the bottom, and we just pop that in the top of the bottle.
Right, yeah, there we go.
Yeah, then you put the lid on the bottle, so it's now airtight. And then you just squeeze the bottle and your paper clips will sink to the bottom.
That's so cool.
The pink divers.
Chris has actually got three in his bottle and he squeezes it and they just all fall down.
Yeah.
And then he lets go and they rise back up. Can you tell us what's going on here and how this relates to diving?
If you've done something wrong, you might want more bubbles or more paper clips. But I'm really pleased that that's worked live, as it were.
Yep.
On air. So, I mean, in terms of science, it explains, it shows us all sorts of things. But if we just stick to one of the things, one is Boyle's Law, which is the relationship between pressure and volume. So the idea of that is that if you increase the pressure on something like these bubbles, you will decrease the volume.
And that's true for all gases, isn't it? More pressure decreases
exactly.
their volume.
Yeah. So what's happening here, when I squeeze the bottle, I'm just increasing the pressure on the little bubbles and so decreasing their volume. And then because of Archimedes' principle, with less volume, there's less buoyancy. So the little paper clips sink to the bottom. And
because the bubbles are now no longer buoyant enough to hold them up.
And exactly.
Their weight pulls them down.
These sorts of principles we can use in all sorts of things to do with diving, but particularly with controlling your buoyancy. If you're very careful, you can sort of have enough pressure on the little divers that it'll just float in the middle of the bottle.
Ooh, yes, challenge listeners. How hard do you need to squeeze your bottle for the diver to just stay in the middle of the water?
And it's actually quite difficult because you can never have perfect buoyancy because anything can affect it. But you can use that, for instance, when you're diving, you might be wearing a dry suit. And you can just, if you put a little bit more air in your dry suit, you get a little bit more buoyancy. Or even, I do a lot of underwater photography. And what's really useful, you can just fill your...
Taking a big breath, can't
taking
you?
Taking a big breath.
So your lungs are full of air.
Yeah, and then you will float higher. So if you're trying to take a picture and you're trying to be very still, because, I don't know, it's very low light and you need a long exposure and you've got to stay still. If you want to rise up, you just take in a big breath of air and you rise up a bit. And so you can control your buoyancy very easily. But there is a downside to this with Boyle's Law and diving is that if you take a really deep breath down in the depths, you know, 10 meters down, and then you come up to the surface without breathing out, because you've got so much more air in your lungs, as you come up, just like
and the
pressure
air
fills
less.
In the lungs.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so your lungs could even burst. And so there's all sorts of things when you learn to dive. But don't worry, it's you know, you get very good training when you learn to dive. But any part of your body that has air in it, like your ears, I mean, many listeners will have experienced their ears popping when they fly. And it's the same when you dive. You've just got to be very careful to make sure you equalise pressure in your ears. And this is all to do with Boyle's Law. And some of this is sort of shown by this principle of the diver that we've done with our bottle of pop.
That's brilliant. Now, I'm also really interested in what it actually feels like to wear a dry suit. Because we've got this fantastic picture of you, which we've put on our Instagram, if anyone wants to go and check it out. And you're holding what looks like one of these quite old-fashioned helmets.
That's not an old-fashioned helmet. That's the latest in diving technology.
I'm sure it is. But to me, I don't know. I've never seen one of those.
No, that's because, I mean, most diving people do is scuba diving. You know, that's the sort of diving of Jacques Cousteau, you know, the...
Yeah.
When I invented the aqualung back in 1942 and all that lot. That's scuba diving with a tank on your back. But commercial diving nowadays... You always do with a supply of air from the surface, and you wear a big helmet, and the suit that you're referring to is a dry suit, and that is extremely good because it keeps you completely dry, so you can stay much warmer for much longer. So whereas on the Mayrose, when we started diving, we were using wetsuits, you could stay down longer than an hour if you really wanted to, but to be honest, after an hour, you'd be so cold, you wouldn't be working very effectively.
Yeah.
And wearing a dry suit helps you work for longer. And in that photograph, that helmet, when you're wearing a helmet, it also keeps your head dry. And that meant we could dive, you know, one of the dives I did was 4 hours.
4 hours.
Underwater, which is much better. And that was because, you know, with a warm head and a dry head and a dry body and air from the surface, it increases the amount of time you can dive.
And how deep is the Mary Rose? How deep down were you?
Well, when, you know, the seabed is only about 40 or 50 feet. But as we excavated the Mary Rose, we were digging deeper and deeper. And during the salvage, we were actually digging under the wreck. So by then, we were down to 70 or 80 feet. And because of some of these laws, and there's the solubility of gas law we haven't gone into so much, you can only spend a certain amount of time underwater. And as we dug deeper, so we had less and less time. So when we started, we could dive for 96 minutes, then 85, then 72, then 57. And by the time of the salvage, it only would have been 48 minutes. So we used different diving techniques so that we could do longer, more efficient dives.
And what is the solubility of gases that you were talking about? Is that to do with the bends and,
yes,
and
yes,
the gas in your blood?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the other sort of demonstration rather than experiment, we mentioned at the beginning, if you bring a complete bottle of a pop that hasn't been opened and get that ready, if the pressure increases, the partial pressures of different gases is increased, so more of them can be dissolved in fluids. So you were asking about how deep we went and so on. As when you go down, the longer you spend down at depths, the more air, you know, nitrogen and oxygen mostly, can get dissolved into the bloodstream.
Than would at normal atmospheric
yeah,
pressure.
Yeah, so if you spend, you know, several hours at depth or even 1 hour at not so deep, all this air, particularly the nitrogen and the oxygen, gets absorbed into your bloodstream and other fluids in the body. And the oxygen doesn't matter because you use it up.
Yeah.
You know, that your body uses the oxygen, but it doesn't use up the nitrogen. So the nitrogen is in the body. And then if we get our bottle of pop, if I decrease the pressure on this bottle of pop.
By opening it.
That one was a bit flat. But you can, let's try another
one. Yeah, you can hear that air escaping.
That one's been shaken. So, and now I'm looking at this bottle of pop and you can see all the bubbles coming out of the liquid. And that is because the partial pressures of the gases, the bubbles are now coming out of that liquid.
So by releasing the pressure, the bubbles have come out.
Exactly. So if you imagine you're diving, you come up to the surface, imagine all those bubbles
coming out in your blood.
Coming out in your blood. And more particularly, say it's in your blood, in your capillaries, you'd get what's called a skin bend because you've got little bubbles in your blood, in your skin. If you get it in a joint, it's really painful. But if you get it in your cerebrospinal fluid, in your spine or in your brain, you know, that's it. That's very dangerous. I mean, imagine having bubbles in your brain or in your heart or whatever. So that's why it's important to do this process called decompression. And science program, it's all to do with Boyle's law and Dalton's law and Charles's law and solubility of gases. So that's why for diving as well as maritime archaeology, all of these sciences are so important.
Absolutely. Time for your third song, Chris, which is Giselle from the Russian Ballet. Now, why have you chosen this one today?
Obviously, I particularly like the music, but in my youth, I lived in all sorts of capitals around the world because my father was in the diplomatic service. And in the 60s and in the 70s, on two occasions, we lived in Russia. And Russia in the 60s was pretty grim. You know, obviously, if you think about modern kids, there was no television, no films that we could see, no laptops, no computers, no iPhones, no mobile phones, nothing. And so one of the few things we could do is go to the ballet. And it was extremely cheap in those days to go to the ballet in Russia. But one of my favourites was Giselle. And there's a lovely point in Giselle where she gets a flower and she's plucking the flower saying, he loves me, he loves me not, he loves me, he loves me not. And that's the bit of music that we're going to hear.
Thank you.
Approximately 19,000 artefacts have been recovered from the Mary Rose wreck site.
That is a lot. Chris, how do you find those artefacts?
Well, they're all in the ship. And what we did, again, using Bohr's Law, you can use Bohr's Law to great advantage when you're diving.
I wonder if any of our listeners can guess that you were once a science teacher.
let's try with that. If you get a drain pipe, okay, and take it down underwater, but then feed into the bottom of it a small amount of air, as that air goes up the tube, it expands.
Yes.
And so as it expands, it sucks water through the bottom end of the tube.
Yes.
So effectively, what you've got is a vacuum cleaner. So we've got a vacuum cleaner that's very easily powered just with gas. In fact, with air, we used Atlas Copco, you know, like a road compressor, which would power up to 10 of these. So using this airlift or vacuum cleaner, we were able to very, very carefully remove the silt from the ship. If you imagine a complete shipwreck, in fact, half a shipwreck, if you imagine that completely full of silt. So if you imagine a ship 35 metres long, 14 metres wide or high, and 7 metres deep, that entire ship was completely emptied. Like you were saying earlier, that quote about Pompeii, it was completely emptied and the finds discovered in there. And this was using 500 divers, and as we heard earlier, 29,000 dives. Just an incredible bit of human endeavour to excavate all these really delicate objects and bring them to the surface.
And a lot of people don't think archaeology isn't considered to be one of the main sciences, but actually there's a whole lot of biology and chemistry and physics going on in what's decaying those objects and how to preserve them. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked a little bit about physics already, but, you know, to be a really good maritime archaeologist, you need to know all sorts of bits of biology and chemistry and everything else as well. And the biology, again, is quite interesting, because when this shipwreck sank to the bottom in 1545, immediately it starts to be colonized by marine creatures.
Mm.
There's bacteria and little things, but there's also bigger things like shipworm. Shipworm is Teredo navalis is the scientific name. And this is it's a crustacean, not a worm, but anyway, it's called shipworm.
Mm-hmm.
And this burrows into the wood and eats the wood. And then the burrow is its home. It secretes a sort of skeleton. So it's like a snail, but it's...
So the ship becomes basically its shell.
Exactly.
a shared shell for millions
exactly.
of shipworms.
And it eats the wood. And it's so voracious. That is really almost what ate away half of the Mary Rose.
Wow.
Or it then weakened timbers so much that they could then break and float away and again be eaten by more Teredo somewhere else in the sea. And then there's another one called Limnoria, which is a gribble. It's a sort of a little bug with legs that walks around, and that eats the surface of the wood. So these two creatures, plus all the other types of decay, meant that half of the Mary Rose was eaten away. So, you know, that's a really important factor in the preservation process. And so that's some biology, which is important. Chemistry, again, we've got some world-leading scientists who've been working on the preservation of the Mary Rose. And they're using a water-soluble wax called polyethylene glycol. Now, if you imagine ethylene glycol is antifreeze, so that's a certain length of chain of molecule. But polyethylene glycol has a longer chain. It has more units. So the chain of molecules is much bigger. And it's a water-soluble wax. And they've been using this wax over, you know, a 30-year period to preserve both the objects and the hull of the Mary Rose. And it's just incredible what they've been able to do using chemicals and
do they put that on underwater, or is it on the things that come out of the water?
No, that's after say the Mary Rose or some of the wooden objects have come out of the water. The most efficient way to do it is to put the objects in a tank with this polyethylene glycol. But something as big as the Mary Rose,
yeah, you can't just like dip it in.
Yeah, because the ship was too big, you couldn't afford a tank that big, and we couldn't afford to buy enough polyethylene glycol to put it in a great big tank. So what they did with that is they sprayed it with this polyethylene glycol, two different types, from 1994 up until 2013. And when they finished spraying it, that enabled us, when they went on to a drying program, to finish and complete the Mary Rose Museum which, I mean, it's just amazing, this ship sitting in the middle of the museum. And in the first 2 years since opening, we had over 1 million visitors. I mean, it's just been incredibly popular.
And what has been sort of your favourite objects or artefacts that you've found?
There are so many. I suppose one in particular. I mean, I've found all sorts of things, whether it's complete chests or cannon or whatever. But one that I particularly remember. Yeah, I mean, they're interesting. But to me, the Mary Rose is not about a ship. It's not about cannons. It's not about warfare. It's about everyday objects. And one object that I remember finding was a spade, literally a wooden shovel. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautifully made shovel. It's made out of one piece of wood, a piece of cleft wood. It's a piece of wood that the grain all runs in one direction, so it's incredibly strong. And the handle and the shaft and the blade are all made of this one bit of wood, just carved out of the tree. And it's just so beautifully functional. And I just remember excavating this, you know, we were talking about using the airlift, and completely excavating it and then holding it up in my hand underwater and realizing the last person that touched this was a Tudor sailor. And I don't know why that happened with that object, but it was so extraordinarily ordinary.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about the Mary Rose collection. We have objects of normal people. It's not just objects belonging to rich people and kings and queens that you see in palaces and you know, posh properties around the country. We've got things belonging to ordinary people. All Tudor life is there, from the very ends of shoelaces up to the Vice Admiral's pewter garnish, his pewter dinner set. And so we've got every level of society represented. And that's what's so powerful about the Mary Rose story.
Yeah, and I guess finding those objects and realising you have that connection to someone who's gone but was there 300 years ago. Mm. So personal.
450 years.
450.
It's a very, very long time ago. Just amazing.
Wow, we'll be coming more onto that in the next section. I guess this is a good time to remind listeners that we asked you at the top of the show, what is the coolest object you've ever found? And do you have any stories of connection or discovery that you can share with us? Tweet us at Soho Radio. Chris, what is your next song going to be and why?
I'm not very well clued up, am I?
It's Space Oddity David Bowie. I believe you've got a little relevant story to this
right.
one.
You were sort of, we were going through different aspects of science that might be relevant to the Mary Rose, and we've sort of done biology and chemistry and physics and so on. So the real challenge is, how can we pretend that astrophysics is related to the Mary Rose? You might think that's impossible. But the story behind that is that one of the divers that we had was always saying that, you know, he was an astrophysicist and what he wanted to be was an astronaut. He didn't just want to be a diver. He wanted to be an astronaut.
I guess they both involve breathing oxygen in harsh environments.
Exactly, exactly. And so we'd say, yeah, of course you are, of course you are. But the next job he went on to was as an astronaut on the space shuttle mission, and his name was Michael Foal, and he, I think, was the first British astronaut. There's a lot of fuss at the moment about Major Tim, but Michael Foal was the first British astronaut. It doesn't seem to be counted because he was born in England, he went to school in England. Some listeners may have gone to school with him, but he was also a joint US citizen. So but Michael Foal was the first astronaut. But, you know, in the news at the moment, it's all about Tim Peake and the, you know, his work up in space, which is absolutely fantastic. So I had to have, as one of the records, Ground Control to Major Tim.
Ground Control to Major Tom. Ground Control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
Ten.
Ground Control to Major Tom.
Eight. Seven. Six.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
Three. Two.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
It has taken over 30 years to conserve the Mary Rose.
What a long-term project. But so we've talked about finding and preserving your artefacts, but actually one of the most important things an archaeologist has to do, and you've touched on this a bit, is understand the stories around those objects and then be able to communicate those stories to the rest of the world. And you are actually head of interpretation at the Mary Rose Trust. So how do you tell those stories?
I'm glad you put that sense of importance on it, because I think that's absolutely right. You know, our duty is to tell these stories, but in a way that is really engaging. And for us, our ideal is to try and say it in a way that is relevant to a 21st century audience. So one of the things I feel about the Mary Rose Museum is that we want it to be the sort of museum that someone would go to who's not used to going to museums. They maybe have never gone to a museum in their life, and they go to it and they have such a different experience to what they're expecting. And it's a enjoyable experience or an interesting experience that they then give another museum a chance. Do you see what I mean? And that the Mary Rose has the potential to really, I think, appeal to almost anyone on the globe because of the objects we've got and because of the personal stories that we can tell. So that's very much the aim, and my job as head of interpretation is to try and achieve that sort of unwritten goal.
And what have we discovered about the Mary Rose and the people that lived on it?
Well, because there's not really an awful lot written down about the Mary Rose itself, the ship. It's only later ships that even have ship's plans and so on. So almost everything we find out about the ship is new knowledge. But also history, I sort of touched on this earlier, history often doesn't record the normal man. It records what kings and queens and posh people do. And by having objects that belong to normal people, I think we can get a much better sense of perhaps empathy with them. We can see how few possessions or how many possessions they have. We can see how they've got some possessions that are really treasured, and we get insights into their lives in that way.
And this was a battleship. And why is it that everyone thinks that it sank on its maiden voyage? As we said at the top of the show, it didn't. It had 34 years service. But where did that even come from, that rumour?
I blame radio shows, Matilda. No, I mean, I think it just gets into sort of history, and quite a lot of history. Historians just repeat what other historians have said, and then it can get into the press and into books, so, and into popular culture. You know, once you start having, I don't know, jokes about, you know, oh, something's useless, it's as useless as the Mary Rose, then do you see what I mean? That's what gets into the culture. But it was a very successful warship, as we heard in that fact, for 34 years. I think that just stories get repeated. And perhaps that's the job of archaeologists as well, is to, you know, we believe in the truth, you see. We just tell the stories that the artifacts can tell. Not history is one person's opinion on what happened on a particular day. Whereas archaeology, well, okay, maybe it's an archaeologist's opinion, but what we try to do is to tell the stories that the objects can tell.
And do you ever have to take a leap of faith? Is there ever a time when you're saying, I don't know, but this would be my best guess?
I think so. A lot of the time, there are some things that we absolutely know, and some things that we can guess at, and some things that perhaps we know are not true, and so we don't tell them. So one of the things that I particularly like to do, working with our volunteers and staff in the museum, is to try and collect what are the myths and legends that are, you know, that people are hearing and then repeating. And it's really important not to repeat myths like the Mary Rose sank on its maiden voyage. One of our, you know, our key principles really are authenticity and accuracy. You know, we should do things that are, it shouldn't just be worthy but dull. Things need to be interesting and accurate. And that is what's so great about the Mary Rose, is that we can tell real stories. It's not Hollywood. It's not Disney World. It's not Madame Tussauds. It's the real thing. So when you look at a chest full of objects that we found from the Mary Rose, it's not a replica. You know, Madame Tussauds and Disney World could do things in either a virtual world or in a pretend and plastic world much better than us. But we've actually got the real thing. So when you walk down one of the galleries that we have on the Mayrose, you can look one side to see the ship and look the other side to see hundreds of objects that we found on the ship. And I think that's very powerful, that it's important that when people go there, they realise that they're seeing the real thing. They're not seeing some sort of make-believe.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, time for your fifth song as we are running out of time. What have you chosen for the next one?
I've chosen Chariots of Fire, the theme song for Chariots of Fire. And that's actually because after the raising of the Mayrose, the year later, I contracted leukemia and was in the London Hospital Whitechapel. I don't know if anyone from there is listening. For 6 months without escaping, or with hardly escaping, and had a bone marrow transplant from my brother. But at the time, the Chariots of Fire was a very inspirational film. And I decided, having watched the London Marathon from the hospital bed in 1983, that I was going to run it. And 2 years later, I ran the London Marathon, and we raised about £70,000, which was a lot of money in those days. And the run was really more to make sure I was getting back to decent fitness levels. And so this Chariots of Fire theme music was very inspirational for me, you know, when I was in hospital. And it's a great inspirational film and a beautiful piece of music.
What an incredible story. Christopher Dobbs, what science news have you brought with you this week?
I think it's got to be the news in January that four new elements were added to the periodic table. And, you know, when I was sort of learning science at school and university, the periodic table was king.
Absolutely.
And, you know, just the thought this January of four new elements being added to it and finishing that seventh row. I mean, that seventh row didn't exist when I was learning it. And I just think it's incredible that, you know, something like 14 or 15 or 17 new elements have been discovered in my lifetime. And that just shows the pace that science is going at the moment.
Yeah, it's really incredible. Well, my science news this week was that they've taken, as part of an experiment known as the lichen and fungi experiment, which stands for LIFE, scientists have taken a tiny fungus found in Antarctic rocks, sent it to the International Space Station, and given it 18 months of conditions similar to those on Mars. So that's a very, very different atmosphere, 95% CO2, and like huge amounts of radiation and pressure. And they found that after 18 months, more than 60% of these cells had survived intact with stable DNA. And this is new and exciting steps forward to life on Mars and whether we could cultivate it. Producer Amna, what have you got with you today?
Something a bit more depressing, unfortunately. This is a shocking consequence of our love of plastic. A report by the World Economic Forum predicts that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the sea.
No.
So I wonder what archaeologists
are going to be finding in the future.
Oh, I don't know. Actually, but you were talking about space and this experiment going up into the space station. I'll add another thing, not related to Major Tim or Mike Fole, but NASA actually took one of the parol balls on Mayrose, so like part of our rigging, and they took it up into space on one of the shuttles.
No way!
And I just think that is incredible. I mean, I don't know what the experiment was to show. It was a bit of PR. But the fact that NASA decides that an object from the Mary Rose, an English thing, this wasn't anything to do with the English space things, should fly around the world, you know, 600 times on a space shuttle. and come back again. It just shows you the esteem that the Mary Rose has internationally and not just in England.
Absolutely. I bet those shipbuilders at the time could never have imagined yeah, part of their ship was going to be in outer space.
But one of the ideas is that, you know, a ship was really the most advanced piece of technology of any society, just like a spaceship is today. You know, the Mary Rose and other ships like it were, or even a canoe to somewhere in Polynesia.
Were the frontiers, weren't they?
Yeah. So, I just thought of that as you were talking about something to do with space and Mars.
That's fantastic. We've had quite a few tweets in, loads of people loving the show, loving your stories. Amna's going to read out a few of the favourites so far.
Yeah. So we had Dante. He says he remembers watching it on TV. Absolutely mesmerised by the Mary Rose surfacing inch by inch. I thought that was really lovely. MJ says that he has been diving and the coolest thing he came across was a pufferfish.
Wow, yeah. Well, that's got lots of air in it.
Yeah. And I think it was a really nice tweet from Hannah as well saying, she's loving your stories, Chris, about raising the Mary Rose. What an absolutely amazing job you had.
It is. And, you know, the whole Mary Rose Museum, it's about telling stories about people. It's a social history. It's not about ships and warfare. It's about people.
Brilliant mix of science and stories. And what is your final song going to be today, Chris?
Well, I think having said that the bit of news was about the elements, I had to have this Tom Lehrer song called The Elements, because I remember it, my parents had an LP of the best of Tom Lehrer and this was on it. And it's just quite fun at the end. You know, there are 17 elements that weren't even discovered when he wrote this song. So listen to this, have fun, and what a great science programme you've got, Matilda.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on today, Chris. I mean, your story is absolutely fascinating and inspirational. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. So here we are, live from Copenhagen, Tom Lehrer with his Elements.
There's atom, warning, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, uranium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium.